Good evening. Bernie Sanders tastes victory in New Hampshire.
Thank you, New Hampshire. Thank you, New Hampshire.
Trump hints he'll pardon Roger Stone as Congress calls for another investigation and anti-nuclear activists face years in prison. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with some of the news for Wednesday, February 12th, 2020. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders sailed to an easy win in New Hampshire's Democratic primary, setting the stage for an epic battle of the future of the United States.
Thank you, New Hampshire. Thank you, New Hampshire. Let me take this opportunity to thank the people of New Hampshire for a great victory tonight. Let me thank the thousands of volunteers in New Hampshire. Thank you. Who knocked on doors in the rain and the snow and the cold. The reason that we won tonight in New Hampshire, we won last week in Iowa. It's because of the hard work of so many volunteers. And let me say tonight that this victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
With 25.7% of the vote, Sanders bested South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg by nearly 4,000 votes, way ahead of third-place challenger Amy Klobuchar, who had just under 20%, and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren with 9%. Former frontrunner Joe Biden got 8.5% of the votes cast. The host of The Attitude on Pacific radio station WNHN-FM in Concord, New Hampshire, is Arnie Aronson. She says she's a politician in recovery, having been the first female candidate for governor of the state. She says despite the media, Bernie won a clear and clean victory on Tuesday.
Bernie really won. Let me repeat, Bernie really won. It was an incredible turnout, which is fantastic, unlike Iowa. Bernie now, instead of just running against Hillary Clinton, now had, you know, 7 or 8 people that he was running against. He was able to deliver the numbers he needed. He won the cities. He won the places where manufacturing used to exist in my state. And what you saw was a real get out the vote and a real sort of active participation. Let's also remember that things in the landscape have changed. A lot of people went into this election undecided, and they weren't undecided based on a progressive wing or the moderate wing. They were undecided on who could defeat Donald Trump. So please understand that even if Bernie's numbers, although he came in number one, he won the vote, a lot of people are trying to figure out who has the capacity to take on Trump. We have no experience with this, and part of the reason that Bernie's numbers may not have been higher is because Trump is such a challenge for everyone as they look at the 2020 November campaign.
So you think that Bernie could take on Trump? Can he beat Trump? That's what everybody's asking.
And here's the question. Can anyone beat Trump? We don't know what electability means in a time of Trump. When you have a tyrant in chief, when you have a liar in chief, when you have a performance artist as president, who the hell can beat Donald Trump? That is the question. And nobody has the answer. I'm just going to repeat that. Nobody has the answer. And as the course of this primary goes through, because remember, we're at the very beginning of this primary, we're kicking the tires, we're evaluating, we're watching the changing political landscape, and we're trying to figure out what are those skill sets that can take on someone who basically avoids the truth and will do anything to undermine the integrity of the result.
Now, New Hampshire, as long as I've been around, has always been a key bellwether in who was going to win a primary and a nomination. Is it still that kind of state?
I would hope so. But again, this is such a unique time for anything that resembles elections and politics. And, of course, we have something going on here that's also unique. Not only do we have Donald Trump, which is a real challenge, but now we have one of the richest men, I think the eighth richest guy in the United States, a fellow by the name of Michael Bloomberg, who has a media empire behind him, who's willing to spend billions of dollars on this campaign and wants to take on Donald Trump. The question with Michael Bloomberg is, can he buy the Democratic nomination and then buy the result?
I see. What Trump also ran, I mean, there was a Republican primary, and it seemed to show that he got some pretty impressive numbers, even though he was running, virtually unopposed, but he was opposed. He got a large turnout.
He encouraged that turnout. The Republicans turned out just to send a message to the Democratic Party. The way that Donald Trump showed up for a huge rally the night before the New Hampshire primary in the center of all the action so he could overshadow the primary just before people went to the polls. Bill Weld ran against him, sort of the only candidate, only he never ran a campaign. He kind of sort of showed up, said I'm running against him, didn't do anything, and as a result you saw 9% of what he got. That 9% is pathetic, but it also reflects his pathetic campaign.
What drove the people who voted for Bernie Sanders? What drove Sanders' victory?
What drove Sanders' victory is that they trust him. There's a level of consistency. He speaks to the issues of working people. And I think the most important thing about Bernie Sanders is that people not only think that he's authentic, but they think that if he gets elected, he won't forget them. That is so important. Barack Obama ran on hope and change. The problem is, where did the change come? He stabilized Wall Street, and you didn't see him really address the issues of Main Street. And I think there was a great sense of disappointment. They liked him, but after 8 years, we still had huge gaps between rich and poor. We hadn't done a lot of the agenda that 80% of us need. What they get with Bernie Sanders is that he won't forget them if he gets elected.
And Klobuchar and Buttigieg, they're much vaunted as the moderate opposition within the Democratic Party, people saying in the various newspapers that if they get together, they could beat Bernie. Is that true?
If they get together, they could beat Bernie. If Elizabeth and Bernie get together, they could beat them. The question is, who can beat Michael Bloomberg? And right now, we don't know because he's not been tested. He's bought a lot of airtime. We know he can spend a lot of money. He's bought practically every operative in the country. He has seeded his campaign for years with mayors and operatives and paying for party leadership all over the country. The question is, will he really win the race? We don't know that. The candidates you saw are all about running for an election. Michael Bloomberg is about acquiring an election. Will the Democratic Party let that happen?
And just final question, why was Iowa such a mess up compared to New Hampshire? New Hampshire was much better run.
Because we are a primary, they are a caucus. Caucuses, by their very nature, are undemocratic. You have to be there at a certain time. It's a very public situation. They had a very, very complicated way of addressing how they were counting people that were voting. It came to percentages. They had an app they had never tested. Then they turned out to have the phone lines jammed by the Trump folks, so they couldn't even call in the numbers when the apps failed them. It was chaotic. It was flawed. And I think the Democratic Party tried to address the failings of 2016, and instead they made a bigger mess. Probably we should revisit the idea of whether we should continue to have caucuses in the United States.
Arnie Aronson is host of The Attitude on Pacifica Radio Station WNHN FM in Concord, New Hampshire. Former Representative Joe Walsh, who lost to Donald Trump in New Hampshire's Republican primary, which was held on the same day, said, "I'd rather have a socialist as president than a dictator." The 2020 census will be sent on April 1st, but in the meantime, the Census Bureau is recruiting people to help others fill their census forms. Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams recently hosted a recruiting session in the hope of a better census count than in 2010, when the borough's population was severely undercounted. Arno Pedram has the story.
This year, the census will be available to be completed in 13 languages, and there will be guides for 59 others. The census has already recruited about 80,000 people through the five boroughs, but New York being a diverse city, Shelley Worrell of the Census Bureau says more census workers are needed.
We're looking for people in every neighborhood, on every block. We are looking for people that represent every nationality, every ethnicity, and speak every single language.
And this year, the census will also be a little different. In the past, only a paper version existed, but the 2020 census will be digital, which means it'll be offered online and by phone too. Worrell says these new tools could help make responses rate a little higher.
We'll be able to see response data live, and that will allow us to employ our partners and other people in the community to actually go to those specific places in which the data shows may need a little help with the responding.
This year, census takers will be paid $28 an hour. Marjorie Rothenberg from Park Slope, who was applying to be a census taker for the first time, says for her, the job has a higher purpose, making sure New Yorkers get government benefits.
Certain people in politics don't want people to be listed because they can cut back on services.
In 2010, around only 62% of New Yorkers completed the census, against 76% nationally. Brooklyn was the most undercounted borough of the city, and that results in limited federal funding going to schools, hospitals, roads, and other public works. For WBAI, I'm Arno Pedron.
Back in May, Representative Carolyn Maloney held a news conference on the steps of City Hall where she introduced a bill to ensure fairness in the census. At the time, the Trump administration was attempting to insert a question about whether the counted person was a U.S. citizen. She says it was an open attempt by Trump to gerrymander districts, cut funding to cities, and steal an election.
The Trump administration is trying to rig the 2020 census for political, partisan gain by adding a citizenship question, which will drive an undercount of the minority community. This unconstitutional question began with Thomas Hoffler, and he was known in the Republican Party as the Michelangelo of gerrymandering. And he wrote a study in 2015 that said very clearly that adding a citizenship question to the 2020 census would benefit Republicans electorally because an undercount would enable more extreme gerrymandered maps that disenfranchise minority communities. After President Trump was elected, Mr. Hoffler relayed his report to the transition team and later drafted key illegal paragraphs of what we now know as a fake request from the Justice Department to Secretary Ross that the citizenship question be included in our national census. I call this request fake because it did not start at the Justice Department. It did not start with political people, not professional people. And in fact, we have seen emails from Commerce Secretary Ross asking for this so-called request to make up a legitimate reason for adding this question at the last minute, violating federal law that said you must plan at least 3 years ahead and test this question. Three federal district courts ruled that they violated this law, and it was capricious, unnecessary, and illegal actions. New York alone receives over $73 billion a year based on census numbers. If our numbers aren't right, then we don't receive the money we need to help our people. And of course, it is so important for representation and the Electoral College and also a legislative district lines. It is literally and truly the backbone of the democracy of our nation.
Manhattan Representative Carolyn Maloney speaking last May. In late June, the Supreme Court put a block on the idea of a citizenship question in the 2020 census, but concerns about the question have remained on social media. You're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Attorney General William Barr has agreed to testify before the House Judiciary Committee next month. The panel's chairman, Jerry Nadler, said Wednesday, giving them a forum to press the attorney general on the sentencing of Roger Stone and other controversies that have emerged in the aftermath of President Donald Trump's impeachment trial. In an extraordinary move, all four federal prosecutors who took the case against longtime Donald Trump confidant Stone to trial withdrew Tuesday after top Justice Department officials undercut them and disavowed the government's recommended sentence against Stone of 7 to 9 years. The cut in the sentence recommendation came after Trump sent an angry tweet.
What about the Roger Stone sentencing?
Yeah, I thought it was ridiculous.
Did you ask the Justice Department to change
that? I'd be able to do it if I wanted. I have the absolute right to do it. I stay out of things to a degree that people wouldn't believe, but I didn't speak to him. I thought the recommendation was ridiculous. I thought the whole prosecution was ridiculous. And I look at others that haven't been prosecuted, or I don't know where it is now. But when you see that, I thought it was an insult to our country, and it shouldn't happen. And we'll see what goes on there. But that was a horrible aberration. These are the same Mueller people that put everybody through hell. And I think it's a disgrace. No, I have not been involved with it at all.
Would you consider commuting or?
I don't want to talk about that now. I think it was a disgraceful recommendation.
What do you think?
They ought to be ashamed of themselves. What they've done to General Flynn, what they've done to others, and then the really guilty ones, people that have committed major crimes are getting away with it. I think it's a disgrace. See what happens.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer had this to say.
On Friday, he began dismissing members of his administration who testified in the impeachment inquiry, including the Patriot Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman and Ambassador Gordon Sondland, a clear and obvious act of retaliation. Very simply, that's all it was, against witnesses who told the truth under oath. President Trump hates the truth time and time again because he knows he lies. And when other people tell the truth, he hates it. So he fired them. The president even fired the brother of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman for the crime of being related to someone the president wanted out. How vindictive, how petty, how nasty. And there are rumors now that the president may dismiss the inspector general of the intelligence community, the official who received the whistle. We are seeing a man. We are seeing the behavior of a man who has contempt for the rule of law, beginning to try out the new unrestrained power conferred on him by 52 Republican senators, one brave one. Left to his own devices, President Trump would turn America into a banana republic where the dictator can do whatever he wants and the Justice Department is the president's personal law firm, not a defender of the rule of law. It is a sad day in America, a sad day.
And that's Senator Schumer. The Attorney General attended a hearing of the Judiciary Committee, which provides oversight of the Justice Department. That's typical for every year as cabinet officials across the federal government march to Capitol Hill after the budget is released. But Barr has not testified before the committee since he was confirmed as Attorney General last year. Barr has been in a prolonged standoff with the committee and even boycotted a hearing last spring. Year-old Liz McAllister was one of the seven Catholic peace activists known as the Kings Bay Plowshares Seven who broke into the naval submarine base in Kings Bay, Georgia on the night of April 4th, 2018 to carry out nonviolent acts of prophetic witness against the government's possession of nuclear weapons. One of those Plowshares Seven activists who is facing jail is Martha Hennessy. She spoke earlier this afternoon with WBAI.
We were convicted in October at a trial where we were not allowed any kind of a defense or any kind of expert witnesses, and we now wait sentencing, which probably should occur late March. Right now there's something called pre-sentencing investigative reports that have to be done and sent to the judge, and it's been taking weeks and weeks, so we are continuing to wait. And Steve Kelly, Jesuit priest, is nearly 2 years now being held at the Glynn County Jail in Brunswick, Georgia, and the rest of us have been out for different amounts of time.
So why are people in and out? How much time did you spend in jail?
Action April 4th, 2018, the 50th anniversary of King's murder, and three of us took bail and bond 2 months after being incarcerated. And then Claire Grady came out in July. Mark Colville came out in the fall of 2018 to have cancer treatment and went back in. And Liz McAllister came out October, right before the trial. She was just sort of released without any explanation. And Steve Kelly remains in because he has an outstanding minor violation out on the West Coast relating to the naval submarine base out there.
Describe this facility.
It's about 17,000 acres. Jimmy Carter gave it to the military in 1979. It's an installation that allows for the maintenance of the nuclear subfleet, of which I believe six are housed and maintained there, along with taking care of the UK three Trident submarines. And most recently, within the past 2 months, they sent out USS Tennessee nuclear sub with a new kind of warhead on board. They're saying it's more usable, it's smaller kiloton than what was used on Hiroshima, and their job is to prowl the seas 24/7 and be capable of striking anywhere on the planet within 15 minutes.
How much jail time could you get?
They're threatening me with 18 to 24 months, the others 21 to 27 months, Liz McAllister 15 to 21 months, she's already served 15. And Steve Kelly, I think, 37 to 48 months. But the charges themselves come with up to 20 years of...
What did you do, exactly?
I posted an indictment on the door of the administrative building, Strategic Weapons Facility Atlantic, Swiftland, posted an indictment saying that this base is a violation of international law, and it's a war crime waiting to happen. We also left Daniel Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine. We poured blood on the threshold. We posted banners that read nuclear weapons, immoral, illegal. The ultimate logic of Trident is omnicide. And we spray painted love one another, may love disarm us all, abolish nukes now. And other folks at two other sites posted banners that read the ultimate logic of racism is genocide, and also the pouring of blood and the symbolic hammering of these missile models. We call it the missile shrine. And
what's that?
It's where they have the different mock-ups of the D-2 missiles that can carry these nuclear warheads and Tomahawk missiles. It was a display, and we called it a shrine. And we wrote things like blasphemy, idolatry, abolish nuclear weapons now. And then the third group went to the actual bunkers where the nuclear warheads are stored. And they posted a banner that said, nuclear weapons, immoral, illegal.
What's the crime? I mean, people get thrown out of Congress for doing that all the time.
We cut a padlock to get onto the military base. And so they don't like having the public going onto these military bases. And so the charges are conspiracy, destruction of naval property, depredation of government property, and trespass. The trespass is a misdemeanor. The other three charges are so-called felonies.
We heard a baby in the background. Is that your child?
My granddaughter. I'm 64 years old, and that's my two-year-old granddaughter.
So you wouldn't, that's a long time to be away if you're put in jail. Is it worth it?
Is it worth it for who? You know, we're facing great threat to humanity. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists have placed the doomsday clock at 100 seconds to midnight. And so that is pretty significant, and that's based on factors that are occurring right now around the globe. And so that's what my eye is on. My eye is not on what is inconvenient in my life and to my family. Everybody's grandchildren are at stake with this, so it's not just about me.
Martha Hennessy is one of the Plowshare 7 activists. She faces nearly 2 years in federal prison. And finally, a Syrian was killed and another was wounded when government supporters attacked American troops and tried to block their way as their convoy drove through an army checkpoint in northeastern Syria, prompting a rare clash. That's according to state media and activists. The U.S. military said its force came under fire and that troops responded in self-defense. It said an investigation of the incident was underway. Syrian state-run media said the man killed was a civilian and that he was among residents of a village east of the town of Qamishi who had gathered at the checkpoint checkpoint and pelted the U.S. convoy with stones. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, February 12th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry and Arno Pedram. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo.